You've heard of the Skinwalker before, right? It's hard to forget a super cool sounding name like that. But do you know what a Skinwalker is? Unless you're a Navajo, probably not. Because although it has been heard about by a lot of people, the legend of the Skinwalker is one of the least understood myths in American history. In Navajo culture, there are light and dark sides to magic. And whenever someone learns the ways of Navajo medicine, they have to learn both sides. So there was always a risk being pulled to the dark side of it. This did not happen to most Navajo who went on to become shaman or tribal elders. But others fell prey to the unnatural side of magic, and these became witches. Skinwalkers were just one kind of Navajo witch. They're shapeshifters that can take on the appearance and sound of any person or animal that they encounter. Beyond these very broad strokes, we don't know a lot about the Skinwalker, mostly because the Navajo considered it to be private Navajo business, not to be discussed with outsiders. With that in mind, the following story takes place circa 1890 in northern New Mexico. Some years before this, President Rutherford B. Hayes carved out a great chunk from the lands that the Navajo had been forced upon as a reservation. This was, of course, after the Navajo had their lands stolen from them and been forcibly moved. Well, after that, they lost even more land. So there was still a fairly substantial area that was the cause of a lot of ill will and had subsequently become very difficult to traverse. The rumors were abound that skinwalkers had cursed the area. They haunted it. And any white man that tried to settle or even step foot on their lands was in very grave danger. There were other, far more likely rumors that placed a band of irate Navajo warriors out there just trying to settle up the score a little. There were other more likely rumors that placed a band of irate Navajo warriors out there just trying to settle up the score a little bit. In any event, if you were traveling from Albuquerque to California, there was a place you most assuredly wanted to avoid. One man decided to go straight through it to save time. To protect himself and his stagecoach, he hired on a crew of gunmen to escort him. But would guns be enough to match the horror of the Skinwalker? This is a brutal little slice of the Old West called Blood in the Sand. Drinking whiskey in the kitchen and telling scary stories around the fire. Music, monsters, and mayhem, killers, cannibals, and cults, fearful fiction and furious fact, tall tales, and terrible truths. This is a Scary Home Companion. Arn and Ole Hostetler were hard-traveling cousins out of Minnesota. They were both Army vets who drifted out west after leaving the infantry, taken to running freelance protection jobs for stagecoaches and wagon trains and the like. Not at first, mind you. For the first couple of years after the Army, they worked as highwaymen. They even picked up a few other guys and started a proper gang. They came to find out that highway robbery did not pay nearly as well as they thought it would, and the risks they were running started to seem a little high. They didn't have a lot of time left over to spend that money on whiskey, cards, or women. So Arn had the bright idea to flip sides and start a protection business. They were going to start protecting folks from highway robbery. The history of violence was the only kind of history they were familiar with. They were brawlers, shooters, card cheats, lousy drunks, but they were as good as their word. They said they protect you, they would do just that. And this was a time and place where reputation mattered. Doing what you said mattered. And after doing this for a few months, the Hostetlers had actually started to cultivate a reputation for being able to get people safely from point A to point B. Said reputation brought them to the attention of a wealthy British expat named Andrew Christie. The cousins had just finished up a long trip from Tupelo, Mississippi to Albuquerque. There had been a little trouble along the way, and the cousins were well tired and ready for a few days of R&R. This British chap, he found them, sought them out in the saloon before they had gotten too deep into their cups, and he offered to pay their whole tab for the night just to hear him out. That's hard to say no to, because these boys could drink. So Mr. Christie, it seemed, had found himself in a bit of a bind. His hired driver slash armed escort had gone AWOL on him after taking some of his money. Now, the silver-haired man explained that he didn't care that much about the money, but now he had no one to drive his stagecoach to complete his trip to the coast. Christie was heading out to California, he said, and then up the coastline, where he and a partner were starting a medical practice. The partner was already there, so for Christie, time was of the essence, and money wasn't. Going through Skinwalker territory would shave 2 days off his journey, and he was willing to pay handsomely for speed. When he started flashing around some cash, promising performance bonuses, the deal was sealed. Neither Arn nor Oli believed in the Skinwalkers, but they did think it likely that there could be a tribe of renegade Navajo out there looking for revenge. So they called a few members of their crew back together so they could be all hands on deck for crossing through the Badlands. They called in their regulars, boys from the old gang that had followed them out of the criminal life and into the side of angels. They knew Tonk back from their days in the infantry. Tonk was terrible at cards, and he smelled worse than a horse, but he was bigger than all hell and an ace with the sharps. Old Joe was a Navajo translator. He'd worked for a lot of years for the army around the time they were forcibly moving the Navajo tribes. The shit he saw in this period drove him deep into the bottle, any bottle he could get his hands on. But even ass over tea kettle drunk, Old Joe spoke Navajo and knew the land better than anyone around. And then there was Spitter, who, well, no one was quite sure where Spitter came from, but he was there all the same, and somebody had to water and brush the mouths. The crew lit out due west at first light. Spitter drove the coach. Old Joe rode ahead to look for obstacles and highwaymen, and the other three rode with open arms around the stage. For his part, the passenger, Mr. Christie, stayed quietly in the coach, all blinds and shutters sealed up tight. 11 straight hours of riding, the man didn't show his face once. But no one blamed him. This neck of the Old West was dull. It was nothing but a sea of shrubs. There are very few trees or picturesque locales up here around the Colorado Plateau. It was mostly just sagebrush, greasewood, shade scale, ugly, ugly sand, the same yellow-gray color as Arn and Oli's teeth. And it was dusted with this fine, misty red that must have been drifting over from that set of sharp cliffs in the distance. It was very slow going, and beautiful landscapes are only beautiful at first. That shit wears off fast. When night came, they made camp under the electric velveteen sky. And under cover of darkness, Christie proved to be an amiable chap. He supplied a handful of cigarettes and a bottle of rum for the lads, and he joined them around the fire, although he didn't eat or drink with them. Old Joe peppered Christie with questions as the rum began to loosen his tongue. Christie said that he hailed from London, where he had worked at a hospital for many years before deciding to pursue a new opportunity here in the New World. He was meeting some old colleagues to join in a burgeoning medical practice for a thriving trading community. In the parlance of the times, Mr. Christie was going to be a sawbones. Arne and Ollie were all too happy to let Joe take the lead with the talking. Neither one of them even knew where London was, excepting for that they knew it was on the far side of one of the oceans. These boys weren't much for talking, but they surely did enjoy killing off that bottle of rum. As the night wore on, just outside the flickering circle of firelight, a fox with a cut under its eye sat down and watched and listened. On the second day of travel, by the time the sun started melting across the dusty edge of the world, the boys were right near the edge of the disputed Navajo territory, the Badlands. Out here, the wind fell dead. It was like the weather itself didn't want to follow them any further. That night, the boys were all still at ease, more than happy to pass around another bottle of Mr. Christie's rum. But they all remembered where they were, so they took turns working a two-man watch. This night, the roles were reversed, and it was Mr. Christie who started peppering old Joe with questions about the local lands, Navajo culture, the medicines they used, the stories they told. This prompted Joe to start going through his normal repertoire of Indian stories, the ones that were the most colorful and entertaining and the least horrifying. Then he stopped cold when he saw a desert fox watching them from the edge of the fire line. Calm as you please. It was the same fox as the night before. He could tell it had the same little cut under its eye. And this spooked Joe. He started throwing rocks at it until it went away. This was, after all, skinwalker territory. Just the mention of the word skinwalker was enough excite Mr. Christie and get him asking more questions, prying old Joe with more liquor and cigarettes until he finally convinced him to start telling tales out of school. Turns out old Joe learned as much as he did about skinwalkers and Navajo culture because the Navajo never believed that a white man could ever properly speak their tongue, and although he was not an expert-level Navajo speaker, old Joe was good enough for the basics. So over the years in the service, he'd heard a lot of stories. One of the more recent stories involved a boy who was out hunting when a red-winged bird had attacked him. It scratched him under the eye and again on the lip, and it flew away laughing at the boy with his own voice. After the boy made it back to his family, he walked in and they were shocked because the very same boy was already sitting with the other children next to the fire. The skinwalker had scratched his face and put it on like a mask. It had a matching small cut under its eye and another right near the mouth. Their shaman had driven the skinwalker out that day, and the entire camp the next day had moved so the skinwalker could not come back and find them. Apparently, skinwalkers used to pull limitless power from the earth, and they used it mostly in pursuit of mischief. They could assume the form of any person or animal just by looking at them. That was the old days. After the white invaders came, they brought with them not only disease and weapons, but they brought their own devils. After that time, the land changed, and the skinwalkers changed with it. When the Navajo were ejected from their traditional tribal lands, it deeply affected them, not just personally as individuals, but collectively, spiritually, it wounded the Navajo people. Even though skinwalkers are evil, twisted things, they are still Navajo. So losing the land had affected them too. It had poisoned the skinwalkers from within, made them crazier, more unpredictable, and weaker. The old magics weren't working like they used to, which also made them desperate. And nothing is more dangerous than desperation. There were rumors that the skinwalkers had started using blood magic. They cut your tongue, they could take your voice forever, and if they cut your face, they would take your likeness from you. Their trickery was no longer mischievous. It was cruel and hungry and dark. Joe heard one man, tribal chief in chains behind bars, who told a story of how the skinwalkers had become so diseased and weakened they had started imitating the white man's religious ceremonies. Under the light of a harvest moon, the skinwalkers would now gather to offer up sacrifices to a foreign devil, cutting open captives, pulling out their organs, and arranging them on the ground under the moonlight. The other Rough Riders all goofed on old Joe, but Mr. Christie was digging the hell out of the local color. He kept prying, kept asking more questions. As a doctor in particular, the arrangement and removal of organs fascinated him. He asked around if anybody had read of a similar case in London some years ago, but of course, no one had. Joe told a few more stories, but his eyes were sharp looking for that fox, which he never saw come back. Still, he never quite settled down. He stayed rattled and started sticking to the tales of the older, simpler days. No matter how much Mr. Christie started pushing him for the gory details of the skinwalkers. After a while, the drinks outweighed the stories, and old Joe plumb passed out. Christie stayed sitting next to the fire, staring at the sky and thinking about the old man's words. There were no animal sounds, no wind. The sea of sawgrass was still. There was just the crackle of the fire. It was like it was the only sound in the whole world. Christie asked Arn and Ole what they thought. And while Arn decided not to comment, Ole had no qualms about calling bullshit on the old drunkard's tall tales. Christie was asleep by first light. Around the same time, Ole roused old Joe and sent him to scout up ahead. The old man swore at Ole, said, "I heard you call me a liar." And he put up his dukes. It didn't come to throwing hands, thankfully, but tensions were high. When the old man ended up not coming back for a while, everyone just packed up and moved out. This was not the first time tempers had flared and he had rode off, since he'd left most of his liquor stash behind. They knew it couldn't be that serious. Still, everyone had a gun handy. Except for Christie, of course. He just kept his nose buried in a book, as usual. He also seemed to be the only one not on edge. The guns seemed to calm him, make him feel safe. It was the better part of a day before they found Joe. He was standing, dazed, in the middle of the trail. No horse, no gun, just standing there, staring off into space. He had blood smeared around his mouth. There was a little cut on his cheek, just under his eye. Joe was not a man easily shook. And still, his voice had a tremble in it when he spoke. And that tremble is what got Ole down off his horse. and over to Joe's side. He had ridden with old Joe over 24 times and never seen him like this. Their personal disagreements aside, he helped Joe to find a seat on the running board of the coach, gave him a little water and a little whiskey. Mr. Christie came out, handed over a full bottle of rum to the old-timer. He drank it down halfway before it calmed him down, and he started to talk. That morning, as Joe scouted ahead, he'd found some unusual signs about a mile up the trail. He followed them back into the woods, where he found the remains of an old wagon train, about a half dozen ratty wagons in a half circle. The place had been savaged several days ago. These were innocent settlers, men and women, slaughtered and torn to bits. While Joe was checking on the dead, he said someone attacked him, knocked him out, and he'd been out for several hours. Arn and Ole, they'd worked with Joe for a long time, and they didn't know him to be an out-and-out liar. Nor did they know him to be rattled over finding some dead bodies. These weren't hardened killers or anything, but in this life, everyone saw more than their fair share of death. So, they couldn't figure out why he would be telling a story like this, but the fact that the wounds on his face matched up so precisely with the old native campfire tale he told the night before, this didn't set right with them. It seemed far too convenient, even if they didn't know the word convenient. They couldn't make sense of it, so they decided they needed to have Joe lead them all back to the other camp so they could see it for themselves. Like Joe had said, it looked 2, maybe 3 days old. There were 2 weeks' worth of fire pit and animal bones, flanked by a few decrepit wagons that looked like they were lucky to have made it this far west. They counted 7 bodies scattered around the camp. Some of them had been stabbed, some had been shot. One of them had been beaten to death with a rock. Christie gave brief, cursory examinations to the deceased, although he seemed a little hesitant to actually get his hands dirty. When they looked at the faces of the dead, they saw that each one had been cut just under the eye. When they pulled open mouths and checked tongues, they found the same cuts. Christie said that it appeared as if they had been cut first and then killed. The women had not been raped, the men had not been scalped. They were just cut and killed. And then opened up. Christie saved the worst news for last when he revealed that all of the dead had several major organs removed. No one there thought old Joe was capable of such atrocities in any way, but it still seemed so suspicious, so they had to ask, Joe, why didn't they kill you too? But at this point, old Joe was already gone. Some distance in between themselves and the dead folks. But without old Joe leading the way, they were hobbled. Arn took the point, but he had to keep a short lead so that they could all stay within eyeline of each other. They only made it half as far as they should have that day, which meant they were still dead center of the Navajo Badlands when the sun started to go down. For some reason this night, it seemed to drop extra fast, streaking yellow bleak towards the vanishing point as if it couldn't move fast enough. cousins both knew the feeling. They stopped, not because they wanted to sleep, or rest, or eat, or even drink, but because they had to. They would cripple the horses, or the stage, or both, by trying to navigate the trail in this darkness. It was a harvest moon. Everything was bathed orange. Still wasn't enough to see very far. Now that they were sure of hostiles being in the area, there could be no fire tonight. There would be no sleep either. Arn, Oli, Spitter, and Tonk were all staying on a 3-man shift the whole night, each one taking turns rotating out for 1 hour of shut-eye. Christy actually spent most of the night out under the stars with the boys instead of locked away in the stage. Without the firelight, the sky above was a fresh and endless marvel, and he drank it in, savoring the sights and the soundlessness of this pure and pristine world. Occasionally, he would take out an old spyglass and use it to peer around the landscape looking for the old man. When Christy finally returned to the stage, it was Oli's turn to take a break, and he came along with him. Oli knew he wouldn't be able to catnap, not on a night like this. So instead, he decided to sit with Christy for an hour and talk. Well, not talk, mostly Oli listened. Mostly he listened just to have a place to sit down that wasn't a horse or the ground. Christy must have been drunk or high or something that night, because he was a damn sight chattier than he'd ever been before. He confided to Oli about how he needed to get as far away from England as he could. He wasn't just coming to America, he was fleeing London. He wanted to find the farthest, most remote part of the world. He'd apparently done some business that he didn't want to elaborate on that made him a person of interest to the law over there. So the farther he could run, the deeper he could hide, the safer he would feel. He'd taken a boat to the Caribbean, that's where he'd found all that rum, gone up to New Orleans, and had been working his way west by stage over the last few weeks. Oli found himself bristling a bit at this news, and when asked, he tried to put it as plainly and calmly as he could. But he explained to Christy that if there was no medical practice out west, then there was no need for speed, and there was no need for any of this to have happened. Out here, a day don't mean a damn thing, it's just a day. Now they had bodies to contend with, and hostile. Christy stammered a bit, apologizing, and explained that it actually was true. He was starting a new practice, and he was meeting with his new partners. He'd just lied about his initial motives. Christy just kept writing and talking and apologizing until Oli finally excused himself. He was still hot under the collar and about ready to pop his cork, and he did not want to punch this man in the face before he got all the way paid. He closed the door behind him and took a long look around. He didn't see Arn, or Tonk, or Spitter. Just a few lonesome horses silhouetted against the low-slung orange moon. He didn't see old Joe either. Not until it was too late. Old Joe came up behind him and hit Oli across the back of the head with a wooden club, and then grabbed his mouth and held him quiet while the others came from the darkness to drag him away. Arn was laying flat on top of the stagecoach. He watched it happen. He saw his cousin getting pulled off by the shadowy shapes, but he was frozen in place. He was stunned into silence. He didn't want to risk moving a muscle, didn't want to even breathe a word of warning down to Christy. Not that the dandy would have been a whit of help anyway. Arn had been up top on lookout, smoking, and he started eavesdropping on Christy's story down below. This distracted him, and he didn't see the movement in the shadows until it was too late. By the time he noticed, there were dozens of shapes. Maybe 40, 50 of them, moving fast, coming in from all directions at once, low to the ground, about human-sized, but moving in a way that humans were not supposed to move. By the time Arn knew what was happening, He saw these shadowy figures pulling away Tonk and Spitter, leaving their horses unspooked and standing there. And now he watched on as old Joe, or whatever was pretending to be Joe, and several others held down Oli, while another man cut his face under the eye. And then they pried his jaws open with a knife and reached into Oli's screaming mouth to cut out a piece. The scream is what did it. Never once in their lives had Arn known Oli to cry or whimper, even so much as complain. And so that horrific, tortured warble that erupted from his face, it spurred Arn into action. He bucked up into sitting position, drew the six-shooter from his belt, and opened fire. It was too dark to see if he hit anyone. That didn't matter. He was just trying to scatter the group. He blasted six, put in fresh shells, and kept shooting from the high ground. All the shadowy figures started running, but none of them were running away. They all stayed close, circling the camp, close to the stage, but far enough away that Arn couldn't properly track them in the shadows. He kept shooting and shooting, but he never knew if he hit a single damn one of them. Then he saw Oli slowly get up off the ground. He spit out a mouthful of blood and staggered towards the stagecoach. In the pale moonlight, Arn saw that little cut under Oli's eye, just like the one old Joe sported. Man, it got in his head, was this his cousin? Or was this one of those things wearing his face? And that made his finger hesitate on the trigger. And just a heartbeat of hesitation is all it took. A short-handled stone axe came sailing out of the darkness and knocked Arn off the stage into a heap on the ground. He was still alive, but he didn't wake up before they got to him. This was a kindness. This way, he didn't have to feel it as they cut his face and tore his tongue. This way, he didn't have to lay dying in the bloody sand and look up to see himself looking down. Mercifully, he died before any of that could happen. And now, silently, the skinwalkers began to gather around the stagecoach. The door opened slowly, hesitantly, and Mr. Christie emerged into the night. He looked around in wonder. Arn was there, standing right next to Oli. There was Tonk and Spitter, and old Joe was in the back. All seven people from the destroyed camp were there. But there were more. There were others. There was a pair of missionaries, a prospector, and what appeared to be a schoolmarm with a half-dozen bloody-faced orphans, all bathed in orange moonlight. They each had blood on their teeth, small cuts under their eye. Mr. Christie adjusted his tie. He took a deep breath, and he started to speak. Skinwalkers were stunned to hear him speaking Navajo fluently. And he said to them, "My name is Jack the Ripper, and I have come a very long way to meet you." Thank you. Thank you for listening to another episode of A Scary Home Companion. Don't you hate it when the story ends right when it gets mind-blowing? Me too. We're all just going to have to keep coming back to learn the fallout from this unholy powwow, but come on. Jack the Ripper and a tribe of skinwalkers in the Old West, you know there's a lot more to this story. Let me know what you think about this story, or any of my stories. Send feedback to ascaryhomecompanion@gmail.com. Find me on Facebook or on Twitter. I am under @NateFlix. Please subscribe to the show via iTunes, Buzzsprout, or click that little heart on Spotify. You can leave reviews for my show on Facebook, iTunes, or wherever handles reviews for podcasts. Music this episode provided by Friends of Ohio with Root of the Old West Convicts, Purple Planet with Prairie Dogs, and two hot tracks from the incomparable Lobo Loco, Psychedelic Blues, Bad Old Demons. Theme music, as always, by Chelsea Oxendine. Links to all this music available in the episode notes. The episode was produced and edited by Jeff Davidson Hostetler, who I must also thank for letting me use a story about his great, 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 great uncles, Arn and Ole. May they rest in peace.